Generalized anxiety disorder affects more than 6.8 million adults. That's 3% of the U.S. population, and yet only 43% are receiving treatment. Panic disorder affects 6 million adults, and women are twice as likely as men to be affected. Social anxiety disorder affects 15 million adults, and social anxiety disorder is common among both men and women and begins usually around the age of 13. Many people also have specific phobias where they're scared of one specific thing. Stress impacts us all, but stress does not necessarily have to turn into anxiety. Yes, anxiety is a reaction to stress. However, what if we reframed how we thought about anxiety and really talked about what is true anxiety and how do we tune in, become more sensitive, and create greater connections? And how do we separate that from false anxiety, the anxiety that we feel about living in the modern world, being tired and yet wired all of the time? How do we recognize that our anxiety might actually be coming from inflammation? And how do we address the silent epidemic that is antidepressant withdrawal? Let's talk more with my guest today, Dr. Ellen Vora, the author of The Anatomy of Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming the Body's Fear Response. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark.
Dr. Ellen Vora is a board-certified psychiatrist, acupuncturist, and yoga teacher, and she is the author of The Anatomy of Anxiety. She takes a functional medicine approach to mental health, considering the whole person and addressing the imbalance at the root. Dr. Vora received her BA from Yale University and her MD from Columbia University and is helping us to understand and overcome the body's fear response. Dr. Ellen Vora, welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Oh, Lindsay, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I am very excited to have you because you wrote such an extraordinary book. I've enjoyed every word that I've read so far. And we know that the U.S. population is more anxious than it has ever been, with upwards of 34% of Americans experiencing anxiety at some point in their lives. And we're talking like one out of nine people, 800 people suffer from a mental health condition, and the most common of which is anxiety. And I love how you have broken down your book. I can't wait to dive into what you've identified as some of the root causes of anxiety and like where does anxiety actually show up in our lives? Because, you know, you're a psychiatrist, you know that the medications that treat mental health disorders sometimes don't work and carry big side effect profiles, and they don't really get at the root cause of why the anxiety exists in the first place. And while not universally true for all psychiatric drugs, the drugs specifically that treat anxiety are also habit-forming and addictive. So they're simply not the best option, especially for children, since we're seeing such a huge rise in anxiety in kids. So talk to us about why you decided to write a book specifically about anxiety.
So I decided to write about anxiety for two main reasons. And one was just that sheer scale of the problem. I was seeing all of my patients coming into my office, and nearly everyone was identifying with anxiety, at least to some extent. And then meanwhile, I have my connection to, you know, through Instagram, through corporate wellness speaking engagements. I have my kind of finger on the pulse of where are people at these days, and what kept coming up was anxiety. But then at the same time, I've always felt like I actually kind of enjoy treating anxiety. And not all mental health diagnoses are a walk in the park to treat, but I really enjoy anxiety, partly because I think there's so much low-hanging fruit and so many things that we could be doing relatively easily that we just don't know to do. So there are a lot of quick wins, and I find it very fulfilling. There's a lot of unnecessary suffering happening that we can turn around relatively easily. So I was like, this is the book that needs to happen right now.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked a lot on the show about hormesis and hormetic stressors. And I love how you start your book talking about the difference between avoidable anxiety and purposeful anxiety. What are the differences between the two?
Yeah, for me, this is really, I stand on the shoulders of giants. And the woman who influenced my work most in this way is a woman named Julia Ross. She wrote a book called The Mood Cure, where she outlines that we have real moods. That's when something happened and we're in a mood as a result. But we also have what she called emotional imposters, or these times when seemingly out of nowhere, we're suddenly irritable or anxious or sad or angry. And if we could really look under the hood and omnisciently know what was going on in the body, in those moments, there's some state of physiologic imbalance, tripping our body into a stress response, impacting our brain, and it manifests as these different mood states. And our brain is always all too happy to swoop in with an explanation. You know, it will tell us, oh, I'm anxious because of that thing going on at work, or this interpersonal interaction that's not sitting right. But that's actually just our brain retrofitting a justification to make sense of what is first a physical sensation. And so that's what I call avoidable anxiety. It's a lot of unnecessary suffering. It's so much anxiety that's actually really caused by a stress response, which is itself related to a blood sugar crash or sleep deprivation, inflammation, something off with our gut health, something off with our hormones, sometimes a medication side effect, sometimes the inter-dose withdrawal that we go into in between doses of medication. So there are so many seemingly benign aspects of modern life that are causing all of this unnecessary suffering or avoidable anxiety. And then on the other hand, we have our true anxiety, which is not something to pathologize. And it's not something that we can gluten-free or decaf coffee our way out of. It's not something that we're here to suppress. It's really here as an inner compass nudging us, saying, slow down, pay attention. There's something that's not right here in our personal lives or in our communities or the world at large. And there's usually a call to action baked into it. It's asking us to sit with that uncomfortable sensation and translate what we're feeling into some kind of purposeful action. And then we don't feel so anxious anymore once we're taking steps to address what doesn't feel right.
Oh, so beautiful what you said there. And we're going to get into a little bit later on true versus false anxiety. But I want to be sure that we really clarify a lot of the root causes that you just mentioned, of, you know, saying lack of sleep, hormonal changes, and you know, I think we could add toxins to that list, toxin exposure, etc. What do you think are some of the most important causes of the epidemic of anxiety?
There are so many right now. We're living in a perfect storm stew of so many. So, I mean, I do think, you know, a very simple one is chronic sleep deprivation. Many people are not getting adequate quantity or quality sleep these days. And, you know, we can point our fingers at a lot of different causes. There are behavioral aspects of this, there's cultural aspects, but I think that a big piece of this, and the part that I find lends itself to easy changes, is our exposure to blue spectrum light after sunset. And that alone is suppressing our melatonin release and disrupting our circadian rhythm. So we're not getting appropriately tired at the right time. And we're just kind of in a rinse and repeat way, day after day, not getting the appropriate cues to let us fall into sufficient amounts of deep sleep every night. That's a biggie. Blood sugar is a really common one. In the modern American diet, our diet is built on a foundation of refined carbohydrates and coffee drinks that are secretly milkshakes and rosé all day. And so our blood sugar is on a roller coaster. And when our blood sugar spikes, it's chased by insulin and then it crashes, which induces a stress response in the body, which for some of us can feel identical to anxiety and even panic, or certainly feeling overwhelmed. And a lot of people are going through their lives with panic disorder, with frequent anxiety, and it's actually just their body's response to a dip in blood sugar. And that's so easily solved. And I've had some patients in my practice where stabilizing their blood sugar, whether that's through a total overhaul to how they feed themselves, or using a hack like taking a spoonful of almond butter in anticipation of their typical blood sugar crashes and giving them that safety net of stable blood sugar, they've walked away from their panic disorder. And it didn't require 7 years of psychotherapy. It didn't require cognitive behavioral therapy. It actually just required stabilizing their blood sugar.
That is fascinating. And you know, it really mimics something that we talk about so much on the show. Like, really and truly, if you get down to what are the two biggest causes of disease, I mean, we talk about the eight root causes of disease, but really, if you get down to it, it's causing an aberration in either cortisol or insulin. Cortisol and insulin, if you can fix a cortisol problem or if you can fix an insulin problem, which are actually not that hard to fix. They're really not. It takes some discipline. It takes some consistency. It takes like wanting to figure out that that's what's going on, but we never get down that deep when we are working with just conventional physicians who really don't think of disease as this origin story. It's all about the symptomatology that's in front of my face. But like you said, avoiding 7 years of psychotherapy and perhaps having to like consider more assertive treatments. I mean, we're seeing people doing ketamine treatments. We're seeing people do years of antidepressants and antipsychotics, and it's just not getting to the cortisol and the insulin that the lack of sleep and the unstable blood sugar is causing.
I love that. I love that framing. And it really points to like, these are the ways that modern life is disparate from what our genes evolved to expect. And I think if you can sort of, if I can add in the expansion pack, I would say like modern life most of all disrupts our insulin and our cortisol. And that's the ways that the way we live is most different from how we evolved. And then I would add in honorable mention for melatonin and estrogen, which I think are also so different in the modern environment. And, yes. And these four hormones alone are really creating so much of the ways that we struggle. And it's just because the modern environment treats our body with such a different set of inputs and irritants and missing micronutrients that we're not able to just have all those hormones function in a way that creates balance.
Yeah. And we need that balance brought back because it is just, we're a train wreck. We're the most anxious that we've ever been. So talk to us about how you define anxiety. You know, what does anxiety mean? And what's the difference between true and false anxieties?
Yeah. So I define anxiety really differently than how I was trained. And I was trained to work with the DSM, our Diagnostic Statistical Manual, just the so-called Bible of mental health. And it's really designed to standardize our diagnoses for the purposes of research studies and to steer management and in certain ways gatekeep certain invasive interventions. And none of that is relevant to the way I approach anxiety. So I realized a much more meaningful classification system was just to think about anxiety as either true or false. False anxiety is that false, you know, avoidable, physically based anxiety that we spoke about. And when I recognize that someone is struggling with false anxiety, The job, the task at hand is to roll up our sleeves and do some investigative work. We really want to identify what is the root cause here. And sometimes it's multiple root causes. And once we can identify it, we can address it at that level, on the level of the physical body. And then someone can just walk away from all of that unnecessary, avoidable anxiety. And then when we identify that something's true anxiety, our task is entirely different. And it's no longer to pathologize or suppress or avoid. It's really about getting still and listening and honoring. And I find that a lot of people are curious, you know, sort of like, what order do you go in? How do you approach this? What's the algorithm? And everyone is a little bit different. But overall, I like to start with false anxiety. I think of this as the low-hanging fruit. We start there. We identify as many potential sources of false anxiety in someone's life. And within reason, in a way that doesn't drive people crazy, you address it, you get their body back into balance. And that clears the air. And when someone's not constantly in a kind of physiologic pinballing of, you know, one false mood state to another, once we've stabilized, it makes it a lot easier to slow down and see that the anxiety that remains is our true anxiety. And it's actually it's a call from our inner compass telling us, here's what's not right, that it's not something to be fixed in the physical body. It's something to be honored and listened to and addressed on a much more psycho-spiritual level.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us about the low-hanging fruit first. Like, what are all of the false anxieties that, honestly, having read a little bit of your book, I think we keep them around so that we don't have to look at the true anxiety.
Oh, that's profound. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So tell us about the false anxieties first.
Yeah, I think what you just said, I have to just like sit with that. I think you're absolutely right. And so the false anxieties, the way I structure it in my book is I create this false anxiety inventory. I almost intend for people to cut it out and just put it on the refrigerator. Because when you're dropped into a false mood state, it's really difficult to have the presence of mind to be like, do I just need a snack? Am I getting my period tomorrow? And so it's helpful to have something just to cue your memory and suggest, like, could it be this or this? So we're all a little bit different. For one person, it's low blood sugar. For someone else, it might be, oh, you didn't get a good night of sleep the night before. Somebody who's sensitive to caffeine, if they had an extra coffee that day, they might be in a panic attack. For somebody else, they might be inflamed. Sometimes it's your gut is being off. Like maybe you ate something you don't tolerate, or you just have something not quite right with your gut flora. Hormones is its own whole complex conversation. I don't really think of the PMS period as a state of false mood. I think that there's actually quite a lot of truth to it. It's a valid state, but there are ways in modern life with estrogen dominance that we're having an exaggerated state in those days before our period. So there's a lot that we can get into the weeds about that, but there are ways that our hormonal changes are exacerbating our anxiety levels. And I think there it's really just helpful to, at the very least, recognize, like, it's helpful to track our cycles. And when everything feels doom and gloom, or we're so irritable, or everything's overwhelming, to just know we're in the days before our period is not to invalidate what's upsetting us, because often it is entirely valid, but it does help take the charge away, to even just a bit, to be like, oh, and that's why everything is feeling extra hard right now. And as I mentioned earlier, the pharmacologic nadir is actually an important concept, because I'm treating, you know, patients in a psychiatric practice. Many of them are on medication, and I'll have patients wake up in a panic every day, but they typically take their Zoloft in the morning. And I suspect that sometimes what's happening there is a pharmacologic nadir, and it's inducing a panic attack. And so for some patients, it has to do with timing when you take your medication, or, you know, not waking up right into your pharmacologic nadir can sometimes be helpful.
And just for our audience, the nadir is the bottom, like where you bottom out, you know, of your drug level, and it's like time to take more.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, that used to be my pet peeve, is like, how are people not defining terms that are obviously not household terms? And here I am doing exactly that.
I find myself slipping into it too, where I say something really complicated and then I'm like, nobody knows what I just said. Yes. And And this also harkens back to something that is not talked about enough when it comes to medications. And we've talked on the show with several geneticists, and you know, we've got ultra rapid metabolizers of some meds, ultra slow metabolizers. And so one person may be waking up in a panic first thing in the morning. The other person is having sedation, having weight gain, having all of these issues that are just because they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. One person's drug level is too low and the other person's drug level is too high because they have different metabolic rates at their enzyme level.
That's exactly right. And I feel like this is a revolution that's upon us, is just recognizing the bio-individuality. And we have somewhat of a one-size-fits-all approach. We have it when it comes to medication. We have it when it comes to, hey, coffee is good or red wine is good for you. And we just have to get real with ourselves about the fact that we're variable. And that's a beautiful thing about genetics, about the omnivorous nature of humans. We're variable, and that's how we can adapt to different environmental pressures. But it also means some of us are more vulnerable or more susceptible to getting out of balance with things that don't get other people out of balance. So that's the beautiful thing about humanity, right? With genes, we are by design omnivorous, and that makes us able to be adapted to different kinds of environmental pressures, but it also means that we might be susceptible or vulnerable in different ways to different pressures. And if you take caffeine, for example, a lot of my patients are my patients because they're sensitive to caffeine. And for one person, they could have a double espresso after an Italian meal, dinner time, fall asleep 2 hours later, no problem. Must be nice to be that person. Sounds fun. And someone else might have the same coffee that's the cool thing to get that everyone's getting in the morning, but then their nervous system is amped up, they're jittery, they're much more quick to fly into a stress response throughout the day. It's just making their life harder. Even though we would say, oh, there's nothing inherently bad with coffee. The research would tell us it has magnesium, it has antioxidants, it decreases our rates of Parkinson's disease and type 2 diabetes. It's a good substance and we all love it. But one person, it might actually be contributing to their anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I would like to point out that we love caffeine partly because we wake up in caffeine withdrawal. And there's nothing quite like the antidote to its own withdrawal. And so mm-hmm. we give coffee all of this credit for being the salvation to a problem that it originally caused. And it's part of why we love it. But I think that for some of my patients, what we do is we very gradually wean off of caffeine, never making any sudden movements with it. So it's a real drug with a real withdrawal, but making gradual adjustments to decrease the overall amount and push it a little earlier in the day can be very protective of sleep and decrease anxiety during the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Because caffeine's also a liar. It's like totally a liar. It doesn't make you feel energized. It inhibits the action of adenosine, which is there to make you feel tired. So you're drinking all this caffeine, which is a direct cause of anxiety attacks and panic attacks. Then you're inhibiting adenosine. And in small children, one dose of caffeine can inhibit the action of adenosine for 3 days. 3 days. And even in grown adults, caffeine really doesn't wear off for at least 4 hours in most people. Even the person that goes to sleep 2 hours is not getting restful and restorative sleep. They're still amped up, you know? So widest, most commonly used drug in the world is caffeine. And like you said, it's real coming off of caffeine.
That's exactly right. And that person who has the double espresso and still falls asleep, you're right. Like even if they're a rapid metabolizer, at best, the half-life for caffeine in their body might be about 3 or 4 hours. And so then it's not like there's no caffeine buzzing around their brain while they're sleeping and they're mm-hmm. able to sleep in spite of that, but it would be deeper, more restful sleep without the caffeine. Mm-hmm. So, and that's easily solved. We don't have to say no caffeine forever anywhere and just have like a total abstinence movement against it, but that person could push it earlier in the day and have a decaf later on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I feel like we've covered the inflammation, which you have a chapter called Body on Fire, and the tired and wired. We talked plenty about sleep. We've talked about hormones. What do you consider to be the, and we've talked about technology, really. I mean, like, ooh, technology is stressful. Trust me, it's how I make a living, is literally in Instagram messages, like, all day long. And you can never catch up. You're never done. And the metrics for what social media platforms want you to produce keep getting higher and higher and higher and higher and higher in order to stay, quote, relevant in their eyes. But what do you consider the silent epidemic?
So the silent epidemic to me is the way that patients are in withdrawal from psychiatric medications. And there's a lot that goes into that. Part of it is that they're unaware that they're in withdrawal. Part of the epidemic is the utter lack of informed consent about the fact that these medications have a withdrawal state. And so there's a lot that goes into this, from one person who was put on a benzodiazepine medication, something like Xanax or Clonopin or Ativan or Valium. And the fact that, you know, they just did what their doctor was telling them to do, and taking this, you know, socially condoned, doctor prescribed, FDA approved medication. And the next thing they know, it's very habit forming, and they're stuck and they can't get off of it. And they're in a loop with it, where when they miss the dose, when they try to taper off, it drops them into panic. It makes them very irritable. It makes it impossible to sleep. It impacts their mood negatively over time. And so people are having a really hard time with benzodiazepines. This has been going on for a long time. It's not publicly talked about enough. But the people that suffer are really suffering, and we need to be addressing this. And then I think even with the less, sort of like a, you know, a pharmacist, a psychiatrist, we can both acknowledge that a benzodiazepine is habit forming, which is a medical euphemism for addictive.
Well, I mean, just look at the pharmacology. It literally acts on the same receptor on the basically the exact same way as alcohol. Alcohol and benzodiazepines are the exact same drugs, which is why they're so dangerous when you add them together.
Yeah. And why they are both sort of this influence that can take over, mm-hmm. where then someone is in a dynamic with, you know, my wine, my Clonopin, and it's really hard. You know, it's almost like, it's us versus the world, like me and my wine, me and my Clonopin. Why are you taking this away from me? Why are you telling me to go to rehab? And it's sort of almost like this, it can hijack the brain, where you really don't even want to envision a world where you don't have this relationship to the substance. And that's the one where it's a more clear cut, straightforward habit forming situation. And I think that what's even more of a silent epidemic is the fact that our antidepressants, like the SSRIs and the SNRIs, that they also have the potential to have a pretty significant discontinuation issue. And I find that the trouble there is that I'll have a patient, I bring up an example in my book, a woman who she was going through hard times in her life. She was going through a breakup. She was sort of unmoored with her career, with her roommates. Nothing was great. Her doctor put on her on Lexapro, and it felt a little bit like shrug. Maybe this is helping. You know, it wasn't an obvious.
Well, that's 60% of people's reactions to SSRI medications is like, maybe.
The data is really interesting in that, you know, unless we're talking about really severe major depressive disorder, it doesn't seem to obviously separate from placebo, which isn't to say it does nothing. Placebo does something as well. And it really just speaks to the fact that our expectation is powerful. But I would be much more comfortable if this was a wholly benign placebo. But so what I see is like a patient like that, you know, she was kind of shrugging and being like, I think it might be helping. And then her life got a little bit more on track over time. She decided to go off of it. And it was when she went off of it that all hell broke loose. And she wasn't sleeping. She was crying all the time. She was irritable. She was blowing up at people. And she was really dark. Like, her thoughts were dark. She was having darker thoughts than she ever had ever before she went on the Lexapro in the first place. And, you know, in the case of this woman that I'm thinking of from my practice, she went back on the Lexapro and everything got instantly better. And to her, that experience told her this medication must have really been helping. I really needed it, as was evidenced by the fact that I went to a really bad place off of it. And then I took it again and it helped again Lexapro saved my life. And I see this trajectory with somewhat regularity. And what it tells me is that, well, we never really got to the root cause of your depression in the first place. It wasn't Lexapro deficiency disorder. It was lack of community, lack of meaning and purpose, lack of sunshine, vitamin D. You were inflamed. You weren't getting enough healthy fats. Your blood sugar was
your gut wasn't producing any serotonin or dopamine.
Yes. So all of this, and these are, you know, problems that we can address, but we don't, because our industry is really just designed to set us up where, okay, I have 5 minutes free with you, and this is going to end in a prescription. Mm-hmm. But so then in the end, she really credited Lexapro from saving her from her depression. But in my opinion, Lexapro saved her from her Lexapro withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And that's a very clear cut state of relief. But it is not an indication that she was in a relapse of her depression or that Lexapro is the solution. To me, that was a state of withdrawal that she was calling relapse, but it was withdrawal.
Yeah.
And Lexapro is the savior because that was the withdrawn substance itself. So I just think that we need to be having a much more clear-cut, explicit conversation about what's happening in our brains and our physiology when we enter into a relationship with these substances. And I don't mean to poo-poo, you know, all psychopharmacology. I do have patients who are helped by these medicines. That's where it gets really complicated and nuanced. But I just want us to be fully aware and giving all patients full informed consent about, here are the possibilities, here's the real effectiveness, here's the real risk of withdrawal, so that someone can go in eyes wide open, knowing what they're entering into and not being surprised 5 or 10 years later, like, no one ever warned me that I was going to struggle to get off of this. If I had known that, I never would have gone on it in the first place.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying, because I take a lot of heat on social media because I'm so outspoken about the risks of medications. And one of the most significant groups that I get pushback from are, number one, type 1 diabetics. I love you all. We understand it's not type 2 diabetes. I love you so much. But the second group are people on antidepressants. And they are saying to me, you can't say that paroxetine on average causes 20 plus pounds of weight gain because it might make someone stop taking their Paxil. And I was like, well, don't you want to know that you might expect to gain 20, 25 pounds? You know, clozapine, you're talking 40, 50 pounds people put on, which worsens the symptomatology. And what you're saying is, if we didn't have this really, really profound, well understood understanding among lay people that these meds should not be stopped immediately, cold turkey, then we are acknowledging in our unconsciousness that they are addictive and that they are problematic. And so if we didn't have that entrained in our brains, it wouldn't be as like, oh, duh, yeah, I'm in Lexapro withdrawal. And I was just talking with a friend the other day who, I can't say he was truly an addict, because he like decided on his own to go to rehab and, you know, all the things that he didn't have quite as disordered thoughts as some addicts do. But he decided to go to rehab to get off opiates. And he's like, the worst thing about being dope sick is that, and dope sick is the colloquialism for what withdrawal is, and withdrawal from opiates is profoundly dope sick. He said the worst thing about it is you know that it will take 10 minutes for this pill that I swallow to kick in and I will instantly feel better. And that's exactly what your patient said, is I started taking it again and I'm instantly better. It's a silent epidemic. You're absolutely right. And I'm glad we got to talk about it. Now, before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. You guys, Amare has 2 new products. And I know it can feel like an uncomfortable discussion, but everybody has sex and everybody wants sex to happen with ease and for it to be fun. So there are two new products, Ignite. There's a men's version and a women's version that will help to improve libido, arousal, and yes, even help you to get to orgasm faster. These two products contain multiple adaptogenic herbs and mushrooms that can help you to have sex with ease. Don't be shy. Ignite your sex life now. Head to lindseyelmore.com/amare to shop for a two-pack today.
And now, let's get back to the show. Let's talk about your favorite ways of just discharging stress on the average day. Obviously, we've talked reduction of blue light. We've talked reduction of caffeine. What else do you recommend?
So I think about the nervous system as like there's three directions to approach that. One is to actually just decrease incoming stress. And that's like, and I love prevention.
Okay. Wow. Okay. What a profound thought. Okay.
It seems crazy, right? But, yeah. And I think that that's where we have some power to set boundaries in our lives, to say no a little bit more often, to navigate the world from a place of our true no, and not just handing out our, in the words of Marshall Rosenberg, our false yes, where we want to people please, or we don't want to have a confrontation or disappoint people. So we say fawn. Yes.
Fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Yep. We fawn.
And we say yes all the time to things that we know in our heart and our gut are a no. And we give ourselves a lot of unnecessary stress that way. The phone, just less phone in general, is a really great way to decrease incoming stress. And I think recognizing that we live in the attention economy, that our attention is the commodity that very smart companies are competing for. They know that if they instill us with uncertainty or doubt or fear or controversy, we will rubberneck and hand over an increasingly large share of our attention, but they'll get more ad revenue, they'll get more clicks, but our mental health is the collateral damage. So we need to navigate the information landscape consciously, eyes wide open, recognizing that we can't just hand over our attention to anybody shouting at us or putting something dazzling in front of our eyes. We need to be thinking about who gets to tell us what and how often and in what way, so that we're not just at the mercy of this industry that plays on our fear response. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's decreasing incoming stress. I think that there's a lot we can do to cultivate relaxation. And so that's things like breath work or yoga or meditation, cold showers and cold water plunging is great. Putting into Spotify, progressive muscle relaxation, or to do, you know, a guided yoga nidra practice, and to just have a little state of relaxation, whether it's a 30-second breathing exercise or a 20-minute guided relaxation, whatever you can manage, putting your body into a state of relaxation is, you know, how we get back to cortisol is dysregulated in modern life. And part of it is that we spend all of our time in a chronic low-grade stress response and none of our time in a state of rest and relaxation or parasympathetic tone. And then the last piece is discharging the stress that's inevitable. And that's where we have a lot of power to say, okay, stress is a cycle. It's like the arousal cycle, beginning, middle, and end. But in modern life, we just don't bring our stress to a place of resolution. And we should look to the animal kingdom where they've kind of got this more figured out. And an animal after a life or death acute stressor will often shake or flap their wings in a vigorous way. They're going to discharge that excess of adrenaline and tell their nervous system that the threat has passed and now it's safe. So we can start doing that for ourselves. And that can be through dancing, shaking, exercise, singing, chanting, journaling, crying, cuddling, hugging. My favorite is crying and shaking. I think that these are such good free medicine. And I do this hippy dippy shaking practice where I type.
It's called trauma release exercise. You gotta get against the wall and like wear your muscles out to where they just like start. It's the best feeling. It really is.
And we need that more. And we're really, it's sorely missing from modern life. And so we have all of these abilities to take our really frazzled nervous system and bring it back to a state of calm.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I recently bought a rebounder specifically for, I was like, you know what?
because I sit on this ball all the time because it's just, it's healthier for you than sitting on a chair. But I was just like, you know, I listened to the words of my friend and one of my yoga mentors. I was just like, I was fussing and just being a little brat one day. And he just looks at me finally and was like, jump up and down 75 times before you speak another word to me. And I was like, and I just start jumping. You can't feel bad after you just jump up and down. It resets your, it's like you said, it discharges the stress and it acknowledges and honors the fact that there's the beginning, middle, and end of the stress response. Totally. So, well, talk to us about true anxiety. You know, now that we have put down our phones, we've truly come off of medications, caffeine, what happens when true anxiety arises? And just give us a 10-second reminder of the definition of true anxiety.
Yeah, the way I define it, it's purposeful anxiety. It's not something to pathologize. It's not something to suppress. As I said earlier, it's not something to gluten-free or decaf coffee our way out of, or even to silence with paroxetine. It's a nudge from our inner compass telling us, slow down, pay attention. You know that something's not right here, whether it's in your personal life or it's in the world at large. Some of our true anxiety just speaks to the inherent vulnerability of existing in a human body. You know, these ideas that we will one day lose the people we love, that we will ourselves die, that there's the potential for suffering. True anxiety is, you know, I think an acknowledgement of that, and that's valid. But I think it is also our body's mechanism for making sure that we pay attention when things are not okay. It's a call to action. And that's why, you know, my goal is certainly not to eliminate all of the world's anxiety. I think we should eliminate all of the unnecessary anxiety. All of that false anxiety is not serving us, but all of that true anxiety is really helping us course correct and get back into alignment. And for one person, that might mean they really have to change their career or get out of a bad relationship. And for someone else, they know that they need to show up as an activist in some cause. Someone else might know that they need to write poetry, and someone else might know that they need to call their grandmother. And it's really just listening to that nudge inside of you that's saying, like, you've been ignoring this, you've been avoiding this truth, but, you know, honor it and then take steps accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what you're saying is you either have one of the eight root causes of disease, toxins, toxicants, and toxic relationships. So you're either saying, well, you haven't addressed one of the root causes of disease, or you haven't done what we are actually here on this planet to do, which is find purpose. Find purpose and give of ourselves so that we make a difference in things that we find meaningful. Absolutely. And so give us a little bit of a crash course on this, like, tuning in, being more sensitive, you know, and how do we truly let go of these things causing us anxiety?
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes it's not to let go, right? Sometimes it's actually just to integrate it into our lives and really orient our lives around it. But I think that, so one thing is just on sensitivity. I have a chapter in the book about how, you know, we all are using this language these days, but how sensitivity can be our superpower. And I really bring in that metaphor about the canary in the coal mine, how, you know, they used to bring canaries into the coal mines because they were really vulnerable to the poisonous gases that could be there. So if the canary stopped singing, you knew that you had to get out. And I think that a lot of anxious folks are sensitive folks, and they are the canaries in the modern coal mine. And so when we pathologize or sort of slander people for being sensitive, when we're like, you're too sensitive, and we say it like it's this derogatory term, we need to recognize, especially for those of us who are sensitive, this is not something wrong with us. Yeah, same here. It's not something that's wrong with us. It is, it's a higher calling. It's a, well, let's put it this way. It's not something that's wrong with us. It is a vulnerability and a gift all at the same time. And it can be a liability because the world is quite loud these days, but we have to recognize it is also a gift and it's also an offering. It's something that we actually, it's a contribution we make to the world at large. And sometimes the person who's more sensitive or more intuitive, they're here almost in a prophetic capacity. They're the ones with their finger on the pulse and sensing something's really not okay here and we need to do something differently. So I think everyone else should say to the anxious folks, rather than stop being so sensitive, it really should be, well, tell me what you know, because we all need that information so that we can course correct as a society. And so that's just like a little preamble about the fact that we need to embrace our sensitivity. Mm-hmm. What do we do to tap in and tune into it? I like to talk about meditation. I do think it's a great strategy for some people, like when they develop any kind of regular meditation practice, which usually we get there by demystifying it and lowering our standards, taking the pressure off. Like, this doesn't need to be perfect. You don't need all the special gear. You don't need 20 minutes of uninterrupted time. Like, that's not always realistic. But if you can have any consistent practice where you show up and tune in, even in imperfect circumstances, this is wonderful. And, but if you can develop a consistent meditation practice, that's a really good way of tapping into what your intuition and your unconscious is trying to tell you. I cover psychedelics in this section because I do think that when indicated, when appropriate, when you pass all the caveats, then it's like this super highway to our unconscious. It's a really great way to know what's going on under the surface in our minds and in our gut. And so I think that there are a lot of different practices. Even the shaking practice we talked about itself can be a way of listening, because it's almost like you excavate things from your tissues. We hold so much in our connective tissue that when we shake or jump for 75 times, it's releasing something. And then we can stay with that and say, oh, that's curious. You know, a memory just came up or a feeling just came up. Let me stay with that and kind of get acquainted with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so just taking that moment to like tune in, you know, and we haven't talked a ton about psychedelics on the show, but we've talked a little bit about there are certain medicinal mushrooms and ibogaine and like, you know, ayahuasca that really it's almost like it's not like an alcoholic who goes to rehab, right? It's almost like the anxiety never existed in the first place. It has the potential to just like unravel it all. And I believe there's a reason that psychedelics, one of the main side effects of them is overproduction of bodily fluids, you know, because you're crying and getting to stuff that you just don't want to look at on a regular basis. Now, this interview is longer than my usual one, but there's so many more questions that I want to ask you. You good? You good on time?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, here we go. So talk to us about your views on sunshine, because I hear they're out of the realm of normal.
Oh, I like this conversation. So yeah, sunshine. I mean, I think that we are due for a little bit of a correction where we have been given this memo that, you know, we must protect ourselves from the harmful rays of the sun. And it's just not so simple. And for one person who might have very fair skin and a strong family history of melanoma, then yeah, they do want to be really cautious about the sun, with an asterisk there that what we really want to protect ourselves from is sunburn. And sometimes avoiding the sun only to set ourselves up to get an accidental sunburn later on is in certain ways actually a higher risk situation than chronic low-grade exposure giving us a so-called base coat that can be protective. But meanwhile, anybody with more melanated skin, our message of avoid the harmful rays of the sun, I believe, is doing them a disservice. And that's where, you know, our skin color evolves relatively rapidly because it's dealing with such a narrow therapeutic window between the risks of skin cancer and the risks of insufficient vitamin D levels. And vitamin D is this thing that's really more of a hormone than a vitamin, and our skin manufactures it in response to sun. And so if you have more melanated skin, you have much more protection from developing a sun-associated skin cancer, but you're much at higher risk of not developing sufficient or not manufacturing sufficient amounts of vitamin D in response to the scant amount of sunshine that we have in our modern lives. So I think sometimes we actually need to find a healthier balance where we reintroduce sun into our lives and go about it smartly, you know, not just tempting fate and getting burned, but slowly building up a healthy amount of baseline sun exposure that's actually protective. And this other dimension of sun, which I actually didn't even really understand at the time when I was writing the book, that I appreciate a lot more now, is that our risk of skin cancer is so much more than a simple equation of, you know, did we get sun exposure and a sunburn, and that happened a few too many times and therefore skin cancer. And it also relates to all the other inputs in our lives, everything from the quality of our sleep and, you know, antioxidants in our diet, but also importantly, what's making up the cell membranes of our skin, what's making up the cell membranes of every aspect of our body. And that comes from our food. And when we are eating this modern American diet of inflammatory, nutritionally bankrupt processed foods with all of these polyunsaturated fatty acids, the PUFAs of our vegetable oils, this is a very inflammatory diet, and it's making the cell membranes of our cells really a lot less resilient. And so what happens is we're much more prone to damage, whereas when we're eating healthy fats, fats that humans have been consuming for millennia, then we're building stronger cells and we're less vulnerable. So I think we've overlooked the role of diet in this, the role of sleep, the role of calibrating our immune system. All of this is going to impact our skin cancer risk. And just blaming it all on sun, I think, is protecting us, but it comes at a cost of vitamin D manufacturing, of all these other photo products that we make in response to sun, and even the impact on our mood and our happiness. We feel
and our
better.
Circadian rhythm.
And our circadian rhythm so much.
It's such, you know, we can't overemphasize how important sleep is in the management of anxiety, and our circadian rhythms are just jacked. They're so jacked. And one of the ways you can help get it back on track, which also is going to normalize your cortisol response, is by simply going outside. Now, I don't know how controversial those views are going to be for my audience, because most of my audience is like, no, I'm not going to put pro-carcinogenic oxybenzoate containing sunscreens onto my skin to protect me. And I remember back, I was working for a company that launched a sunscreen product, and trying to explain to people, like, what does SPF mean? And, you know, because when they launched it, they were like, SPF 10? I need, like, SPF 100. And I'm like, so you're planning on being out in the sun for like 100+ hours straight, you know, because SPF is, if you were outside with no sunscreen on, what amount of UV light radiation would you absorb, and how much would your skin melanin respond? Right? So an SPF of 100 means that it's going to take 100 hours to make that same change. So if you're someone who goes outside for an hour and is like, got a little bit of sunshine today. Okay, so you need that to take 100 hours now while you're using a literal pro-carcinogenic toxin on your skin. Makes me sick. I hates it. Now, let's talk body positivity. Everybody, you know, everybody wants to talk about, you know, I'm perfect in the body that I'm in, and yet there's that, like, there's that subtle undertone of like, but wait, but there are some bodies that are unhealthier than others. And while I'm all about you being you, boo, we got to have a more nuanced conversation about body positivity. So talk to us about that, because God, people, I just watched The Rise and Fall of Abercrombie and Fitch last night, and just the way that they traumatized an entire generation of teenagers of thinking that you gotta look this way in order to be cool. Huge cause of anxiety, but how do we become more nuanced about the discussion?
Yeah. Nuanced is really the key here. And like, first, an acknowledgement, exactly as you put it with Abercrombie, we are coming off of, we're in the wake of toxic diet culture and even a toxic wellness industrial complex, sort of all of this messaging saying you're broken, you're wrong, you need to be thinner and do better. And all of this really invalidating messaging that's telling us that we're wrong. And understandably, so many of us have rebelled against that and we've run the other direction. So I think there's been a pendulum swing, just a nudge too far in the other direction, which, as my friend Elise put it so well, she's like, and then I just started eating like a teenager as a rebellion. And I think that what happens is that we ran away from the influence of the toxic diet culture, and we happened to run right into the arms of the processed food industry, which is psyched that we're here championing its cause and basically saying, like, do whatever you want. And, you know, are you addicted to Doritos? Great, because don't make yourself small to please the patriarchy. And I'm here to fully agree with the spirit behind don't make ourselves small to please the patriarchy. Don't eat in a certain way from any viewpoint of self-negation or self-punishment or, you know, anything like that. But we've actually just ended up running right from one toxic industry into another, and we don't realize that yet. And where we need to arrive in this happy medium place is that the way we choose to feed ourselves comes from a place of radical self-love. We're making choices based on what serves our body, recognizing we're worthy of feeling good. And when we just swing the pendulum away from trying to make ourselves small into doing whatever the hell we want, we end up just kind of taking on a lot of different food addictions, from processed foods that are engineered to be hyper palatable while being inflammatory and nutritionally bankrupt. So, you know, I think of one particular patient in my practice, and she was really adamant about, you know, she felt like she had been harmed from the diet culture industry, and she ran the other direction, and she was eating exclusively processed foods. And feeling really proud of that, feeling like that was the act of self-love, was to not just like eat healthy food from a place of, you know, self-negation. But she had polycystic ovary syndrome, she had endometriosis, she wasn't getting her period, she wasn't pooping, she was always depressed and anxious, nothing felt good. She wanted to have a baby and she couldn't conceive. And what I realized is that, you know, this was always an attempt to feel good, to run away from toxic diet culture, but then sometimes these easy foods are making a harder life. And so for her, it actually did require feeding herself in a different way, which was anathema to her. She really didn't want to make dietary changes because she associated that with toxic diet culture, but to do it from a very different mentality of one of self-love and one of body intuition and really being in a relationship to her body of what her body's asking for, what it needs, how she can best serve her body. That's when she started to eat in a way that kept her in balance. She did eventually actually get her period back. She did eventually conceive. And so it's like a really beautiful success story, but it required finding a different, a happy medium that's neither about toxic diet culture or about championing, like do whatever you want, eat all the addictive foods either. It's really none of those have a place in this conversation. It's a relationship with yourself where you choose what to eat based on the answer to the question, well, what would be the radical act of self-love in this moment?
I love it so much. It really sounds like the work of Janine Roth. Janine is one of my favorite authors. She wrote a book called If You're Going to Eat Out of the Fridge, Pull Up a Chair, because she's so about, like, you got to sit down while you're eating, friends. And she deals with people with food addictions that for years have just stood at the fridge, just, and so she's like, if you're gonna eat out of the fridge, just pull up a chair. But she wrote another book called Women, Food, and God. And she basically said, your relationship with your spiritual self is right there on your plate. The amount that you love yourself the amount that you love God or universe or spirit or whatever you call it is right. It's right there. It's right there as a direct reflection of our respect for something greater than us that also lives in us. And so you say spirituality is a big part of your approach to anxiety management. And so how does spirituality play into, how does lack of spirituality play into the genesis of anxiety? And how can becoming spiritual in the way that you understand God can help with anxiety management?
Oh, I really appreciate that segue. And I want to read Women, Food, and God.
So good.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that this is, it's delicate because it's outside of the purview of my training. I'm a psychiatrist. And we did not talk about spirituality. We're very squeamish about this topic. It's not our responsibility. Don't go there. But I realized I was doing my patients a disservice by not at least giving them permission to seek, to explore, to revisit these questions. And we're all in a different relationship to it. You know, some people, I have patients who really felt like organized religion was thrust upon them in childhood. They're really in a swing of rebellion away from that now. And, you know, that's right for some people. And I have other patients who grew up without any religion or any spirituality. And that's something I identify with. I grew up in a culture where atheism was cool and we worshiped at the altar of science and skepticism is a virtue. And so I have found in my own life that I had to arrive at a connection to spirituality completely on my own in adulthood. And it's given me an immense amount of comfort and meaning and, you know, and even motivation to feed myself better, right? Like it gives you, you feel much more imbued with love. And that's not necessary for everyone. I'm certainly not here to proselytize that. It's really just, I want to make sure that we're asking the questions and where we arrive, where we land is totally personal truth. But I think we're in a cultural moment where we need to at least reapproach those questions, because in our rebellious KonMari of organized religion, we've missed out on the way that we gather and contemplate existence. Mm-hmm. And I find that when it comes to anxiety, especially that true anxiety, where it's the inherent vulnerability of walking this earth in a human body, where we stand to lose the people we love and we will one day die, that can be so triggering and so anxiety provoking, because anxiety centers around themes of certainty and control, as if any of that exists. And when there is some acknowledgement of the possibility that what might be occurring here in human existence is vastly beyond our comprehension, I find that it softens the edges around that. Loss feels less absolute. We feel less like it's all up to us to be hypervigilant, which is anxiety catnip, to sort of feel like it's up to us to protect this one precious moment. And I find that when we have some just playing at the edges of what does it mean? What is happening here? It just makes it a little bit less terrifying, the vulnerability of being human. And I find that that actually is very soothing balm for anxiety, to open up to the possibility that there's more than what we understand occurring.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I so agree. I was listening to a Christian sermon the other day, and the woman who was preaching said, for those of you that have been hurt by organized religion, just remember, God did not do that to you. Jesus didn't do that to you. You know, and in yoga, we could say the same thing. Like, people have been abused by the yoga community, but Buddha didn't do that. You know, the Hindu gods did not do that to you. That was just a person. A person did that to you. And so, oh, for those of you healing from trauma that has led you away from any kind of spiritual practice, I just encourage you, take another look. Just take another look. Well, Dr. Ellen Vora, it has been an extraordinary conversation. I have enjoyed every single minute of this. Listeners, if you would like to learn more about Dr. Vora's work, head to www.ellenvora.com. That's Ellen and V-O-R-A.com. Dr. Ellen, thank you so much for coming and being a guest today on The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Oh, Lindsay, thank you so much for having me here. It's been a delight.
The delicious combination of Edge Energy Plus and Mentabiotics is back in stock. That's right. You heard it here. Happy Juice is back. Head over to lindsayelmore.com/amare and get your happy juice. You can select between either a watermelon or a grape flavor of Edge, and you can get the naturally caffeinated pomegranate lime flavor of Energy Plus, or choose to go with a sugar-free, caffeine-free dragon fruit blend. This happy juice helps to boost your mood and motivation, provides overall health for your second brain, your gut. It enhances mental performance and provides fuel that you need for a highly productive day. We have Amare Edge, which boosts mood, motivation, and metabolism. Mentabiotics, that improves gut-brain axis to optimize our mental wellness. And Energy Plus, to deliver rapid improvements in our brain and physical performance without any of the crash and the jitters. The combination also, over time, can help you to shred belly fat, reduce the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles, and help to reverse the appearance of age spots. If you haven't shopped with Amare yet, head over to lindsayelmore.com/amare and save $10 off of your first order. If you have enjoyed Amare before, head to amare.com and add Happy Juice to your subscribe and save order right now. lindsayelmore.com/amare saves you $10 on your first order. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag at Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.